Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Dublin's Talking Sport is back after the Christmas break, and we've another wonderful show lined up for you. I have a good chat with Ken about all the controversy in world snooker at the moment, with 10 players being suspended for alleged match fixing. I also talked to Stephen O'Brien of the UK Packers about the cardiac arrest suffered by Damar Hamlin in the recent NFL game, as a freak accident caused his heart to stop during the game. Declan Drake gives us an update on all of the local GAA, and I talk to the one and only Simon Delaney about his new show, The Red Devils Roadshow, which is in the Civic Theatre on the 15th of January. And as always, we finish up the show talking to Alan Cawley about the FA Cup. So download the show now, wherever you get your podcasts. Morning, Ken.
Sure, it'll be a great show.
Right? Yeah, whatever, yeah. I'm not in favour of this. This is going, you went over my head on this one now, getting a Red Devils show on. Simon Delaney, well, anyway, I'll forgive you this time. Good to have you back, buddy. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, and Happy New Year to all our listeners as well. Looking forward to the new year. And it started off very well. Manchester United winning last night, into the next round of the LFA Cup. Rashford's on fire, Red.
Oh, yeah, the FA Cup, it's top of your priorities now at this stage. I know it always is. Yeah. You guys keep banging away at that. We'll keep banging away at the Premier League, you know. Yeah.
The Carabao Cup is our priority. Why the FA Cup?
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong there. Anyway, I have a good feeling about 2023. It feels like it's going to be a good year. Certainly plenty of great sport to look forward to as well. We've got the Rugby World Cup a little bit later on in the year as well. There's loads going on. But I have to say, we'll get on to the snooker because it's not a great start to the year for snooker, it has to be said. You better fill our listeners in. There's a lot of this. We touched on it before Christmas. There's all this betting scandal, but it's really blown up entirely now.
Yeah, it has, yeah. And it's sort of marred the beginning of the Masters, which starts tomorrow as well, because two of the lads that were playing in the Masters, Zhao Xintong and Yan Bingtao from China, have both been suspended until the investigation into match fixing and betting, I think, as well. But there's also 8 other Chinese players that also have been suspended. So, it's not a great start for the snooker year. And it all happened from one of the young lads who was the whistleblower. He was sort of being coerced into sort of losing matches a certain scoreline, like 4-0 or 4-1 and whatever.
Mm.
And he blew the whistle on Liang Wenbo, who's the perpetrator, the initial perpetrator, and it all sort of unraveled from there.
And Ken, you know, there's 10 of them approximately involved in this. They're all living together in Sheffield. You know, obviously COVID created that. So they're kind of over in Sheffield, living together, working together. Yeah. Ultimately, the probe and the investigation, it's going to have to go back a long way, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, any matches that those 10 players were involved in over the last period of time, this is a big deal.
It's a huge deal, yeah. And, you know, some of them are very vulnerable young lads, but some of them aren't. Some of them are very experienced. And for the life of me, I mean, Zhao Xintong, as I said, he only won the UK Championships in, 2021. Yan Bingtao, the same in 2021, won this Masters Championship, both in the top 16, both earning lots of money. Why would you do such a thing? Why would you get embroiled in this something that could change your life and ruin your snooker career?
Yeah.
I don't understand that. You can understand a little bit, even though it's completely wrong, for lads down the bottom who are not earning anything and are sort of more vulnerable to something like that. But not these guys at the top, and I don't understand it. But you're right, it will have to go back maybe a little while. And all their phones were taken off them. They've gone through all their records. So the investigation is still ongoing, and it should be concluded by, the end of February, I think.
And it's not just a straightforward thing, though. I know Jason Ferguson has come out and said that punishments could be, and Jason being the chairman of the WPBSA, he said, like, these charges could be challenged. It's hard to prove. It's like, because lifetime bans, I know Sean Murphy is talking about they should all be banned for life if they're found guilty. There's a lot to trying to enforce all of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think lifetime bans are sort of, they're not achievable because they could be challenged in court. I think that's what Jason was saying. Mm. However, you could still give players bans that would effectively end their career, just like Stephen Lee did. He got a 12-year ban 8 years ago, you know, so he won't be able to come back. And when he comes back, he'll have a big bill in anyway to pay, like for costs and court cases and whatever. So, lifetime bans are not achievable. However, hefty bans and fines are very, very achievable and could basically sort of finish off a lot of these lads' careers, you know.
Okay, fair enough. And
It's very sad. I'm shocked, Reg, you know. It's very sad for any sport. But the only one positive thing I would say about this is that, you know, snooker is monitored by our own integrity unit and by Sport Radar. So any sort of peaks and troughs in betting, you know, unusual patterns of veteran is monitored every single match. And these have been caught and they're going to be dealt with. You know, a lot of sports over the years have sort of brushed things under the carpet a little bit, you know, and not dealt with it. But we will, and World Snooker will deal with it very, very severely. So that would be the only sort of positive out of this. I mean, you know, but there are no winners. There are no winners.
There aren't, it's an unfortunate situation. As you said, it can happen in any sport. It has happened in any sport.
So
keeping on top of it is the most important thing. So it'll be interesting to see. We'll keep an eye on that and see how it all unfolds. But you did mention the Masters, of course. It starts on Sunday, is that correct?
Yeah, it starts tomorrow.
Yeah.
Top 16 players in the world.
It's a brilliant Romeo event.
It's a great event.
Yeah.
It's in the Ali Pali. They just finished the darts there, which was a great event as well.
Yeah.
And then the snooker moves in for a week. Starts on Sunday, finishes the following Sunday. 2,000 people every session. Almost completely sold out. I think this the last 5 days, I think, are sold out already. But I'm sure by the time it starts, the rest of the days will be sold out as well. It's just a brilliant event. Great atmosphere. Great crowd. The London crowd. And it's going to be it's another great tournament. It's on BBC, it's on Eurosport, and probably Ronnie O'Sullivan will be the sort of the main contender. But there are a few lads there that could possibly win it this year who are playing really, really well.
Like who? Don't leave us hanging. Come on, we might have
Mark Allen, who's won the Northern Ireland Open, won the UK Championship
form is
before
good.
Christmas. His form is very, very good. Mark Selby has shown a little bit of form, just won the English Open as well before Christmas in December. So, the likes of Judd Trump, the holder, Neil Robertson, is playing Sean Murphy in the opening round. That's the first match on Sunday afternoon. That's going to be a cracker as well.
Yeah.
Those two played in the final there not so long ago, so that's going to be an absolute gem. John Higgins is always there. Mark Williams. You know, you could make a case for a lot
fantastic
of the
names, isn't
16,
it?
You know?
Yeah, really, really good list of names. And just on the outside chance, form-wise, from what you've been looking at over the coming up to Christmas and that, is there anyone, leave Ronnie out of it, who would you be your kind of dark horse?
An outsider. Well, he has a tough, very tough match against John Higgins in the opening round, but I like Jack Lazowski.
Okay.
He's a left-hander. He probably should have won the UK Championship. He should have beat Mark Allen in the semi-final. He's been knocking on the door. So for an outsider, you know, he's a guy that I think a lot of the guys on the tour would love to see win a big event, because he's a lovely lad. He's very talented. Just hasn't got over the line, the winner's line yet. You know, he's been 6 times, I think, he's lost in ranking finals. But he would be a very popular winner, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, look, you mentioned the darts there just before I let you go, and the Ali Pali, the usual madness that goes on there for 2 weeks over Christmas. It's the only way to describe it. But what that leg? What about that leg? Michael Smith, Michael Van Gerwen, two boys going for 2-9 darters. Van Gerwen misses one that you think you're getting in sleep, and then Smith pops up and gets one. It's just unbelievable darts, wasn't it?
It was, and sport is, you know, its greatest. Like, you know what I mean? When two of the guys are playing at the top of their game in a major final, you know, great atmosphere as well, and that's why it's compelling. It's great watching, you know, it really is. Yeah. And I'm delighted for Michael Smith, I must say. Bagheera has won it a few times. Michael Smith is first. You can see how much it meant.
Absolutely.
All the emotion poured out afterwards, which is always great to see on TV as well. It's brilliant.
For a bit of football build-up now, the Red Devils Roadshow is coming to the Civic Theatre on the 15th of January, and it's hosted by the one and only Simon Delaney along with Tom McDermott. I'm delighted to have Simon on the phone now to talk to us about the show. Good morning, Simon. How are you?
Morning, Reggie. How are you, my friend?
I'm not too bad, buddy. I'm not too bad. Now, don't be expecting. Ken is not here, so there's nobody going to be blowing smoke up your backside about United and how great they are, as loyal a fan as you are, and I know it well. Yeah. But tell us about this roadshow. What have you got in store?
So this was kind of born from a WhatsApp group that I started a couple of years ago amongst pals who are United fans, and over the years it's kind of grown, and there's quite a few people in it now, a few famous faces and that, and my co-host Tom McDermott, we've been following each other on Twitter for a couple of years. He's a Manchester-based United journalist. He's very well connected in the club, so he joined the group, and we've been chatting over the last kind of year or so, and we had the idea about putting this show together, and it's billed as a group therapy session for United fans, because it hasn't been the best 10 years, although I think if we put the show on 6 months ago, it'll be very different than what we're going to be putting on next week. So it's basically a walk down memory lane. We're going to look at the former glory days. We're going to talk about the current crop of players, the manager, what's happened with the situation with the club for sale, transfers. We've got one of a member of the double 94 winning team is going to be on the show with us. We've got Al Foran, who's the voice of many United personalities and a United fan himself. And we're encouraging then the audience to get involved in terms of the Q&A, because, you know, I think it's key at the moment for United fans to know where the club is at the moment, and Tom can provide us with information in terms of who's coming in, who's going out, and what's happening with the sale of the club. And it helps then that we're, you know, only one defeat in the last 17, seven wins in a row, and the match is on the day after the Manchester Derby, Reggie. What could possibly go wrong?
Couldn't be better. We've had Al on the show here a couple of times a year, right? He's a fantastic supporter and great, you know, comedian and interpreter as well. So like, it's kind of apt to have someone like him involved. But I suppose what I'm wondering is, you know, it seems like a much more positive time, because I'm always slagging Ken, obviously, over United, me being an Arsenal fan, but it seems a much more positive time of recently. Do you think they're turning a corner slightly? I mean, are the good times on the way back?
Well, I mean, I don't know about the good times on the way back, but, you know, one defeat in 17 is good. I mean, if they repeat that form for the second half of the season, there'd be silverware on the table. But, you know, they have a tougher run ahead of them. Watching the coverage of the cup game last night, listening to Roy Keane, he's saying, you know, they've had easy fixtures. Yes, they have. Excuse me. But they were games that they would have drawn or lost in the last two or three seasons. They are on a good run. There's no doubt about it. Ten Hag is, I think, not just me, but a lot of United fans think that he is the man. He's instilled a culture of discipline, commitment, work rate, and that's evidence on what's on the pitch. He's also developed some sort of a cohesive unit. They seem to want to play for each other. They want to play for the manager. A lot of, quote, the poison, unquote, that was in the dressing room over the last couple of seasons is now gone.
Yeah.
Some of the bad influences, some of the prima donnas have left, and what's left is he has the nuts and bolts of a decent squad. Yes, he needs to add to it. We're short up front. When we think back to the glory days in terms of strikers, United had, or Fergie had, four at his beck and call, with Cole, York, Sheringham and Solskjaer. We've two now with Rashford and Martial. You know, and Rashford's on a great run of form, but he's playing every game, Reggie. And you know yourself,
it takes it out
at some
him,
point he will need a break, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the feeling amongst your WhatsApp group and the fans that you're talking to about the owners? I mean, it's always talked about, get rid of them, new owners, blah, blah, blah. You know, is that how you feel? Is it time for a complete shake-up?
Oh, I think so. I mean, but, you know, it's always a case of be careful what you wish for, because, you know, the grass is always greener, Reggie. There's no doubt about it that the Glazers are, you know, they're parasitic owners. They're taking so much money out of the club. They went from being overnight from being one of the most financially successful sports brands in the world, second only to the New York Yankees. Overnight, they were £500 million in debt. You know, that begs a bigger question in terms of how they were allowed to leverage the club to buy the club. They borrowed money to buy the club, and then they put that debt onto the club's balance sheet.
Yeah.
And what they've done since is just take dividends from it. They've personally taken out over, I think, around £1 billion in the 14, 15 years they're there.
Incredible.
They're not interested in the club in terms of its history, in terms of its results. Yeah. All they're interested in is the bottom line. And as long as that attitude is there, the club's never going to succeed. They've had a merry-go-round of managers, all of whom have continued to break records of the previous bad manager had. And they've had decent managers. They've had Mourinho, Van Gaal, you know, proven managers, but they just couldn't work with the squad that they had. Going back to what I said earlier on, there were bad influences in that dressing room. Ten Hag seems to have got what he's wanted in terms of his transfer targets. His first transfer window, he signed probably two of our best signings in the last 10 years, Casemiro and Martinez. They've certainly made a difference to the team. And then you add in Anthony, who's, his form has fallen off, but he can make a difference. And I think he's going in the right direction, Reggie. Whether the glory days are back, I think we're a few years away from it.
Very good. Okay. Well, you certainly, it seems like there was a little bit of therapy going on there this morning, Simon, as well, before we get to the 15th of January. But just to state it again, it is the 15th of January in the Civic Theatre. Tickets are available at all the usual places now, are they?
Yeah, civictheatre.ie is the best spot to get them. And we're going to have a few spot prizes on the night, including a little trip to Old Trafford as well. So again, it's a show where audience are encouraged to get involved, and we'll have a bit of crack. We'll help each other.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, good luck with it, and I hope the therapy goes well and they have a nice big comfy couch to sit on for the evening. Now it's time for football. I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Alan Cawley to talk about the FA Cup. Hi Alan, how are you?
I'm good, Reggie, how are you?
I'm great, happy new year to you. It's been a good good break, and looking forward to 2023. And the FA Cup is back this weekend, of course, and I was talking to Simon Delaney earlier, don't know if you heard it or not, but a good win last night for United. He was happy, 3-1 over Everton.
Yeah, it was a good win, Reggie. And they're going well.
They are.
I think that's 7 wins on the bounce now. They're just going about their business in a kind of under-the-radar kind of fashion, which is kind of good, to be fair. I think Erik ten Hag, if you consider when he came in, the job that he had to inherit in terms of the rebuild and all that stuff and the transition that was going on at the club, I think he's gone about his business very, very well. He obviously had the sideshow Ronaldo, which I think he dealt with very well. That's out of the way now. And he had her in very good form. A lot of the players playing very well. Rashford is obviously playing very well. And I think they are going about their business. And certainly, when you look at the league table at the moment, they're only 9 points behind. I still think it's too far a gap to bridge, not just with the points on the board. I also think just in terms of where they are in their development as a team and him only coming into the job, I still think they're a bit off winning the league. But I think it's a very realistic target that they might win an FA Cup. And you look at that performance last night, I think it was quite good. And if they can maintain this form, I think they have a really good chance of going far in the competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I think Simon was saying they've only lost one of their last 17 games. It's quite a turnaround. I mean, we didn't know where we were at the start of the season with them. And you have to say, it is a successful turnaround, no doubt about it. Really, really good performances, and he's starting to get the best out of those players. So good stuff for them. And as you said, I think obviously the Premier League being that stretch too far away from them, I think if they could get some sort of silverware, it would really boost the club. So FA Cup is one that they'll definitely target. There's some other interesting ties in it as well this weekend. Liverpool taking on Wolves. That's by no means a foregone conclusion for Liverpool.
No, certainly not. When you look at their form as well, they're very, very patchy, Liverpool, at the moment. And you look at the game against Brentford the other day, and they were well beaten, Reggie, and there's problems, I think, in a few different areas. It's not just one issue. Obviously, Nunes hasn't hit the ground running and missing chances, and he's not scoring the goals that they expected him to get. But I think they have problems all over the pitch. Midfield area, defensively as well. Van Dijk is out now for a month, but regardless of the injury, I think he hasn't been performing well. Also, Trent has been a liability all season defensively as well. So Liverpool have plenty of problems, and I don't think it will be a foregone conclusion. Obviously, Wolves have a new manager, Lopetegui, has come in and have picked up a little bit and done a lot better in their performances. So it'll be a difficult game for Liverpool. I just think with home advantage, they should get the job done. I'd say Gakpo, the new signing, will probably play as well, which might give them a bit of a boost. a boost that they need. But I think they will get over the line, but it won't be a foregone conclusion, you're right.
Yeah, the other one I'm looking forward to is Brentford West Ham. I think they're fairly, you know, in this competition, they'll be fairly evenly pitched. So it should be a good old battle, that one.
Yeah, and there's the team now as well, Reggie. Like, we all talk, especially this time of year when the cup comes round, about the magic of the cup and how it's been lost, really. And you think back to our childhood and growing up and how big the FA Cup was, and we all loved it, and it was absolutely amazing. And I still love it, and it's a pity the way it is gone, because obviously there's bigger priorities for the clubs now in terms of staying in the Premier League and winning Champions Leagues or whatever the case may be. But certainly for the likes of Brentford, who were sitting pretty in the Premier League, doing very, very well. They've had a brilliant season, a really good manager. I think this is a competition out of the Asia target, because you can imagine how good it would be for that club and those fans if they were to get to Wembley and win an FA Cup. So they're having a brilliant season, and I'd love to see the likes of them go far in the competition.
Yeah, the other cracking one is City against Chelsea. Now, these are two teams that both actually need to do well in this competition. City have kind of, they've been faltering a bit. That's the way you're going to have to describe it. Given the talent that they have, they're faltering. 7 points off us at the top. Chelsea certainly are going in the wrong direction. So both of them need a big performance in this competition.
Yeah, definitely. I watched the game the other night, and City, as you said, were very underwhelming, particularly in that first half. But the second half, then, they make a couple of changes and they kind of up the intensity, and they get the win and get over the line. And they're just doing okay at the moment, Reggie. And as you say, for the quality that they have in the squad, we're expecting them to be blowing teams away. And maybe we're putting too much pressure on them at times for that as well. But with the quality that they have, that is the expectation. Chelsea are a totally different kettle of fish at the moment, because, to be fair to Graham Potter, he's obviously new into the job. A big job for him as well, a big opportunity, and there's major transition going on at Chelsea at the moment. And even look, they've a lot of injuries, but you look at all the young lads that finished the game as well the other night, and they're certainly going down that road of trying to flood a lot of the young players as well. So I don't expect them to get the job done against City. I think City will, even though both teams will probably make changes, I think City just have too much strength and depth for Chelsea. But I wouldn't be judging Chelsea just yet either. I know, as you say, they're going in the wrong direction and they're on a bad run. Like, you look at, we're speaking there with Man United on a really good run. Chelsea are the complete opposite at the moment under Potter. But he is new to the job, and that's going to take time. And I hope to give him the time, Reggie. If that was the previous regime, he'd be under serious pressure now and probably on the verge of the sack. But I think because of the job in hand and in terms of what he has to do with the rebuild and the transition, I hope to give him that opportunity, give him the chance. And I think under Todd Bowley, he has already referenced that he's fully aware of the job and why he brought Potter in, and they're going in a different direction. I hope he is given that time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Alan, what a big year 2023 is going to be for sport. We've got the Rugby World Cup coming up, but of course, we also have the Women's World Cup coming up, and everybody really, really excited about that. Although there was a bit of bad news during the week. I think the ticket allocation was pretty poor for the Irish supporters. Wasn't it 1,400 or 4% of the available tickets?
Yeah, palfrey is the word, I suppose, Reggie. When you look at it, I think the stadium holds 52,000. I know it's the opening game and they're playing Australia, who are one of the hosts, and of course they're going to have the majority of the crowd, but 1,400 is desperate, really, when you look at that for a ticket allocation. And when you think of the Irish diaspora over in that part of the world as well, there'd be a huge interest from Irish fans trying to get tickets. The one thing, I suppose, with the Irish fans, they always manage to get tickets, but I just hope maybe the FAI kick up a bit of a fuss, because when you think of the years that the girls have obviously tried, and this is their dream come true now, and to qualify for a major tournament, you would hope that they get the support that they deserve in the ground. You don't mind the fact that Australia are going to have the majority, but you'd expect maybe 25-30% of the Irish crowd at the games as well, and hopefully that's the case.
Yeah, but there's great excitement in the build-up to it already. You know, hearing it being discussed, and I'm sure it's something you're really looking forward to, and you know, I think the Irish team, they're going to do well in this.
Yeah, absolutely, Reggie. As we've discussed before, I followed the team out for the last 2 or 3 years covering the games and seeing their development and seeing them go through the highs and the lows of trying to qualify for a major tournament, and the disappointment prior to this one of the Euros missing out, and obviously now they've got over the line and qualified for the World Cup. So huge excitement and huge anticipation. I'm really looking forward to it myself. As you say, I think they've been a breath of fresh air throughout the campaign. The emergence of Katie McCabe, Denise O'Sullivan, they've been absolutely brilliant in becoming household names, and hopefully that's the case going forward now for younger girls. When they see the girls lining out in a World Cup final, it'll be absolutely amazing what it'll do for the country as well. So I'm really, really looking forward, and I agree, Reggie, I do think they'll do well.
Oh, it's time to talk rugby, and I'm delighted to welcome back Irish independent journalist and left-wing podcast co-presenter Will Slattery. Good morning, Will. How are you?
Good, thanks, Reggie. How are you?
I'm great. Happy New Year to you. Great to have you back. And it was an interesting Christmas period. Plenty of rugby going on, plenty in the build-up to it as well. I don't know what to make of the state of nation at the moment, rugby-wise, with the provinces. Obviously, Leinster are happy and in control, but the rest of them, it's hard to know where we're at. I mean, Munster are getting a little bit of a feel for the new systems that seem to be getting put in place down there after a rocky start to the season, and they held firm and got a good win against Ulster. But Ulster, then, you'd have to say, seem to be falling to bits. What's your own thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'll just do a quick whistle-stop tour through them, maybe, to kind of give people the state of play. Like, Leinster, you know, swept the board over the Christmas period, and I looked up a statistic that's very interesting, is that since Stuart Lancaster teamed up with Leo Cullen at the start of the 16-17 season, they played 51 Interpros and won 42 of them, which is a staggering amount of success and dominance over their three biggest rivals. So it's no surprise that Leinster have A, been hoovering up most of the trophies since then, but B, are like the lion's share of the Irish internationals also, because they've just held it over all of them. I think they've won 17 of the 20 games against Munster since Leo Cullen took charge, which is an unfathomable number considering the rivalry was so kind of keenly balanced in the years before that. But to Munster, you know, it's interesting. Like, the win last night, getting that bonus point, it was crucial as well, because they left a lot of points on the table early in the season. And although their kind of win-loss record is pretty mediocre, I think they're about 50% for the whole season. The fixture list really opens up for them in the league over the next while. They have Benetton away, and then they have three home fixtures in a row against, I think, Cardiff, Glasgow, and the Scarlets. Mm-hmm. Very, very winnable games. So they could definitely kind of climb the table into the playoff spots. And I think everyone over the last few weeks would agree that even though they didn't get the win over Leinster, say, there definitely seemed to be some positivity. There definitely seemed to be a different vibe around the team, both in how they're playing, but in also how they're being received by Munster supporters. I was down in Cork over the Christmas period, and even though they lost to Leinster, a lot of people were actually pretty positive. They're saying, I heard people say to me, this is the most I've enjoyed watching Munster in years. And that's an important kind of message to be hearing from the supporters when there is growing pains and teething problems with implementing a new system. I think if they get to the end of this year, having qualified for the Champions Cup, gotten into the playoffs, gotten into the knockouts in Europe, and made like a leap forward in how they want to play the game, I think that will actually be a major win, even though the win-loss record might be kind of similar or even worse than what it was under Johan van Graan. As for Ulster, this game against Benetton this afternoon now is a huge one. Like, they've absolutely nosedived. You've Dan McFarlane coming out saying they're soft rugby-wise. You know, not soft mentally or physically, but rugby-wise, he says they're soft, which, whatever, reading through the lines is a very stark thing to say about your own team. And then as for Connacht, again, they have a really big game today. The Sharks have rested their entire team and their coaching staff coming to Galway, so this is a must-win game for them to get back into the playoffs. So all the provinces at varying kind of levels at the moment, but all in very intriguing and interesting places, you know, heading into the new year.
Yeah, interesting is the word, all right. I mean, Munster definitely, they could have even won that game against Leinster, let's be honest about it. Certainly, they looked like they were in control, and they'll kick themselves for that 10-minute period where they allowed those two tries to be scored in quick succession, because that cost them the game, essentially, when they should have been in control with an extra man and everything. So that's what they look back and rue. But Ulster, I can't for the life of me work out how Ulster go and lose that game to Munster. I mean, they seemed to be in control of the match. They were ahead for all of it. And then they just fall apart at the end. And it just, it's hard to see. I know what you're saying about Dan McFarlane talking about rugby soft, but like, it's hard to see light there for Ulster. I mean, with Munster, you can see some light. You can see that they're making progress, and we can argue that. But it seems to go the other direction for Ulster. And excuses are kind of wearing thin now at this stage.
Yeah, it's a funny one. Like, so Dan McFarlane came in the 18-19 season. Obviously, everyone knows the off-field stuff at that stage that had really plunged the province into kind of disarray. But even on-field, their results were very poor. In year one, he got them to the Pro 14 semi-finals, and he got them to the quarterfinals of Europe, where they only lost to Leinster because of a Jacob Stockdale howler and an unbelievable Ross Byrne kick. So he kind of almost overachieved at the start of his reign. They got into a final then in year two. And now the growing pains are almost starting to come in now, like, because the squad has plateaued, I think. He's been able to bring them to a certain level, but either the mentality of the squad or the quality of player hasn't been there to get over the line. Personally, I actually think mentally they're still reeling a bit from how last season finished. They blew a game against Toulouse they should have won. They were seconds away from beating the Stormers in the semi-final of the URC, which would have given them a home final in Belfast and a really strong chance to end that trophy drought. I think that kind of broke them a little bit, to be honest. I would question the mentality in that squad. Like, you know, it's unfair to single out one player, but I do, when I look at the team sheet, Billy Burns, a 10, does jump out as someone who isn't good enough probably for them to get to the next level and win a trophy. Like, there's a lot of good out-halves in Ireland, but I don't think any of them are playing there up in Ulster at the moment. And then, like, even Dan McFarlane's comments at the moment, he's done a really good job. I don't think anyone would look at that and say he hasn't done a good job from where he took over. But this is his fifth season. Like, at the end of a season five, if you're trending, hurtling almost in a downward trajectory, like, what do you do? Do you kind
that
of...
That can't be considered a good job, Will. That can't be. I mean, yeah, you know, like, we spend plenty of time here analysing Munster because, you know, it's great debate for our listeners. And, you know, Leinster... They're producing week in, week out. It's hard for us to debate them because they're doing it all the time. So we can't debate them. But Munster, we debate regularly. Yeah. And we're giving out about coaches and coaching staff and systems and that are not producing and the players that they have. And now they're turning, it seems, a bit of a corner. And, you know, Europe is still an option for them. But Ulster haven't progressed. They've gone backwards.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I suppose when I say he's done a good job, it was up to this season. He had done a good job. Like, Ulster, if you look at that squad, like, that squad is not a squad that should be expecting trophies. It's a squad that should be hoping to get into knockout games, and then with a bit of rubber the green, they could progress. The issue for them is that when they've gotten to these knockout opportunities, they've blown them in, like, kind of really heartbreaking fashion. And then this season, since that Leinster game, because it's funny to think back, what is it, 6 weeks now, when they played Leinster at the RDS, they were having a really strong season up to that point. I think they'd won every game but one, the home game to Leinster, which they only narrowly were defeated. They had a 19-point lead, was it, you know, coming up to halftime against Leinster. And then since squandering that just seems to have completely knocked the stuffing out of them. Like, it reminds me a bit of when Ireland lost to England in the 2019 Six Nations opener, when they came in great guns, and then one defeat kind of, like, shattered the kind of mentality of the squad or all the momentum they'd built up, and they really struggled to wrestle that back. That's what I think today is a massive... Like, they picked, like, a full-strength team to go to Benetton the week before they play La Rochelle away. That tells me that they might actually go away to La Rochelle with a weakened team and might almost raise the white flag in Europe. And they're saying, you know, this is a really important game for us and we need to get points on the board and get some momentum back. Because realistically, like, they won't beat La Rochelle most likely,
no,
regardless.
They're done.
So you might be better off focusing on this game and then the home Sale game and beating Sale and getting into the Challenge Cup. And then maybe rebuilding your confidence and momentum in the Challenge Cup, where you could win a trophy. The final is in Dublin. You could have a big crowd there potentially. And you're still going to be playing some quality opposition. So it's not as if it's, you know, an easy cakewalk. You're still going to be tested. So... yeah, they're in a really, really bad place. If they lose today with the team they put out,
I mean, look, Benetton, fair enough, but I don't know that they will lose today. But I still, I suppose I've been thinking about it a lot over the break and the state of play within Irish rugby, and we're all so excited about the World Cup and we're all over the moon about where Ireland are. We're going into the Six Nations, albeit Johnny Sexton has an injury concern now, but we're going into the Six Nations probably more confident than we've ever been going into it, and all is good. But if you sort of just dig underneath the surface a little bit, we're so heavily reliant on what Leinster are bringing to the table, with a smattering of very good Munster players that are added in there as well, and one or two Ulster players. But we need, in as much as we need a strong Munster, we need a strong Ulster too. And I mean, as you said, you're looking at that team and you're just looking at weaknesses. But it's not good for Irish rugby. It's not good. Like, if Leinster go through a period of... you know, let's just say they go through a period where all of a sudden all of their players aren't firing and, you know, they're not providing the bulk of supply, then the Irish team is in trouble, because there needs to be at least three strong provinces with Connacht backing it up to supply those players and keep pressure on positions, keep pressure on players. Otherwise, Ireland will ultimately suffer.
Yeah, for sure. Like, at the moment, you have one province that is motoring at the top of European rugby and you have two that are kind of in mid-table, basically, and then Connacht, who are, you know, on a good day, fighting to get into that mid-table bracket across, you know, European rugby. That's not good. Like, And if you look for Ulster to go back to them on why they're maybe not playing well, you know, when you're a team like that, you need your key guys to fire. Like, Leinster have so many key guys that if one or two don't play well, there's enough there to pick up the slack. But look, like Jacob Stockdale, for instance, he's basically played, he has played a lot of rugby this season. He had an injury that ruled him out for a couple of weeks. He's been anonymous pretty much this season. He's been, not only has he not been kind of playing well, he's barely been mentioned in games. You know, you have someone like James Hume who's also been injured, but has also been playing really poorly. Like, he was very poor in that. And another thing, sorry, the Ulster players who played in that A game against New Zealand, who got absolutely shredded, that seemed to knock their confidence as well, because some of those guys came into Europe with big prospects of playing. Michael Lowry, James Hume, even Ian Henderson, since he's come back from injury, he missed that tackle on Jack Crowley in midfield that ultimately led to Munster's winning score.
Yeah.
Like, I know he missed the start of the season, but you need your key leaders. That's one of the reasons Munster have been playing better recently, is that their key guys, when they've come back in from Ireland duty, have actually been really, really good, which maybe in the last couple of years, they haven't hit their straps quite as much in the red jersey. You need your Ireland internationals to fire when they come back. That's why Leinster are so good, because when they play in blue, they are absolutely irresistible. Whereas some of these Ulster guys who have big reputations are not playing well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the reason I was concerned about it a little bit and thinking about it so much is that we're sitting there, number one in the world, and it's a fantastic situation for us to be in. And there's this amazing positivity around Irish rugby, and I'm one of the people spouting that positivity. I think it's amazing that we are where we are, and I'm just a little bit concerned that we're sitting there, as you said, with only really one province that are pushing with a real chance on a regular basis in Europe, and two that are kind of, well, Munster have a real chance obviously, but Ulster are gone now out of it, and Connacht are, you know, in the division below. So you're kind of saying, how are we sitting at number one, beating the world's best on a regular basis, yet our provincial system seems to be in a bit of disarray, apart from Leinster, obviously.
Well, you said the keyword, apart from Leinster, who supply 20-odd players into the national squad. And when you can supplement that with a sprinkling of two or three guys from Munster and Ulster, you end up with a really cohesive and a really good 23-man squad with other guys. I take your point about if Leinster come back to the pack, but to be honest, there's no indication that'll happen this year, given how well they're, like, they are a team on a mission. They want to go unbeaten, they want to win every game this year, and like, you know, be like the perfect team, the perfect season, double winners, send the lads off Lancaster and Stetson into the sunset. So I actually wouldn't have that concern about Leinster falling back too much. I just think they're motoring so well. But I do agree that, like, the Six Nations will be really interesting, like, because I mentioned the 2019 Six Nations campaign earlier and how that derailed Ireland completely in a World Cup year. Like, the fixture list now, like, you have Gatland back in Wales. That's the first game. Ireland haven't won there since 2013. I think they've lost the last four matches there in pretty painful circumstances. All of a sudden, that is a monster game for Ireland. They play France the next Saturday. So, like, if they lose the opener, you have France come to Dublin. Their tails are up. You know, you have Borthwick coming into England, who I think will improve them just by the fact that he won't be chopping and changing as much as Jones, and it'll give them a clearer identity. Like, it could be a very successful Six Nations for Ireland, but I think a lot is riding on that opening game against Wales, and that's why I'm kind of a little kind of apprehensive like yourself. But I'm kind of having kind of 2019 maybe flashbacks where, like, we thought we were in a really good place, and then all of a sudden things changed quickly. I don't think it'll turn out like that, but it is in the back of my mind, kind of a nagging little doubt, especially with Gatland back in the mix. You know, he's that kind of wily old character that always gets his team up when they play Ireland. So that's set up to be an absolutely mouth-watering opening game of the Six Nations.
Yeah, it's hard to see where he'll get the talent from for Wales, so that's the only issue. I suppose my concern, just to put a final comment on it, is my concern is forward planning. That's the way I'd be looking at it. I'd be going, yes, we're in an absolutely wonderful position at the moment, but for the development of the game, you need a strong Munster to encourage, you know, younger kids to take it up and still want to be playing for Munster. Same with Ulster. You know, it doesn't seem to me that there's a conveyor belt of young players coming through the system up there, equally so down in Munster, and you just worry that we're becoming over-reliant on the one province to just provide the conveyor belt of players to Ireland. And, you know, it's not Team Leinster for Ireland. It should be the four provinces with everyone contributing. And that's my concern, that it's just slipping away a little bit from outside of the pale, you know.
Yeah, but, and just one comment on Leinster even. Like, if you actually look at the players, say, post-COVID who've come into the Leinster setup, they have not been as good as the guys who came before. Like, there hasn't been an unbelievable player to come into the Leinster setup, in my opinion, since like Dan Sheehan a couple of years ago. Like, the quality of the school's players, they're still good players, don't get me wrong. And you have like a guy like James Culhane, who hasn't really played for Leinster yet, who was a great under-20s player. But some of the young players that are being rolled out for Leinster at the moment, I would question whether they will be long-term contributors to European Cup success. They're part, like, you see some of the guys when they go to other provinces, they don't play as well. They don't sustain what they had at Leinster because they're not playing alongside, you know, 10, 12 internationals per week. I do think there's been a little bit of a dip in quality. There was probably a period from 2012 to 2018 where year on year there was like three or four guys coming out every year from the Leinster school system who you were like, these guys could be Leinster starters, Champions Cup contributors. I don't think, and I don't know, to be fair, COVID has been massively disruptive for, you know, schools rugby. There was cup competitions cancelled. They didn't probably get the pathways that the lads who came before them got. But I have been watching over the last couple of years and kind of wondering, is it as good as it was maybe 5 years previous? So I would watch that space because, as you say, if the production line slows down a little bit post 2023, when Sexton's gone, Lancaster's done, they won't be getting the same level of coaching potentially. Mm. It will be interesting to see what would happen to Irish rugby as a whole. Because, as you say, if Leinster drops back, Irish rugby drops back because they're so heavily reliant.
Yeah. I mean, the point I'm making, I suppose, is you can't take your eye off the future. You know, you've got to be always planning towards that. They'll argue that they are, but it's hard to see it when you're looking at the provinces not performing the way you'd expect, you know, and especially in Europe. Although there's another question for you. I mean, what are you making of the European, the Champions Cup? You know, you look at situations where you get teams like Gloucester sending over a second string against Leinster, which, you know, disgusted me. 57-0 to get beaten in the early stages of an amazing competition. And that happens on a regular basis in this with the other teams as well. I mean, has it lost its glamour a little bit, the Champions Cup?
Yeah, it's certainly lost its glamour and its kind of its prestige from the, you know, the kind of, when you were playing maybe in the mid-90s, where like every weekend was an appointment viewing. Obviously from Ireland, we still love it. We watch every Champions Cup game involving an Irish team, but it definitely does not get that buy-in in England. It doesn't get that buy-in in France. For me, there's two issues. The format, they still haven't settled on a good format, the format that works. I'm not saying here that I have all the answers to that, but this 24-team, two groups of 12, you can basically win two games and go through. So Gloucester basically got their win with a bonus point. They said, okay, we have a tough game against Leicester on Christmas Eve. We don't actually need to win in Leinster. We won't win in Leinster even if we send over our frontliners. Let's rest up. It was a pragmatic decision from George Skivington. But, you know, one thing, like, the South African team should not be in this tournament, not because of the quality. I've enjoyed watching them in the tournament. The travel element, asking a team to go to South Africa and have to pitch with the same guy 7 days later is unfeasible. It's ridiculous.
Thank you, Reggie. Happy New Year to you, indeed all our listeners, on this, the first Saturday of what we hope will be a successful one on the playing fields of Dublin GAA across all four colds. The calendar has hardly been hung up on the wall for 2023, and the action is back underway with the traditional pre-season competitions in the inter-county scene. Dublin, the defending Auburn Cup champions, opened their competitive season last Wednesday night under the lights in Baltinglass as they took on Usheen McConville's Wicklow. After a tight first half, at the end of which Desi Farrell's experimental development squad of players led 7-6, they really opened up after the break to record a 2-15-9 success. Temple Oak Sing Street man Killian O'Gara and Colin Baskell at Ballyboden St Enda's raising the green flags for the Blues, playing in their new kit for the first time. So well done to them on that win, and the campaign continues next week with a Parnell Park date with Offaly on Wednesday evening. To hurling now, and after last year, several counties for 2023 have new managers, with one even returning to an old stomping ground, that being Davy Fitzgerald in Waterford. In Dublin, there was a changing of the guard, with one Galway man replacing another. Micheál Donoghue is the new sheriff in town, guiding the fortunes of the Blues hurlers this year. He has his first taste of competitive action in his new role this afternoon when Antrim come calling to Parnell Park in the opening round of the Walsh Cup, a competition, of course, Dublin were successful in 12 months ago. That game throws in this afternoon at the Nell at 2 o'clock. We here at Dublin's Talking Sport take the opportunity ahead of the game to wish Micheál and his new management team every success in achieving their targets for the year ahead. Back to football. Tomorrow is a big day for our back-to-back county and provincial champions Kilmacud Crokes, who played their third consecutive game at Croke Park as their bid to win the AIB All-Ireland Senior Club Championship steps up a gear. It's semi-final time from 1:30 at headquarters, with Kerins O'Rahillys of Kerry standing in their way of a return to Jones's Road in a fortnight's time for the decider. Croke's boss Robbie Brennan, who watched the Kingdom men in their Munster final pre-Christmas down in Mallow, spoke to me during the week of the challenge that awaits his charges on Sunday.
Yeah, I went down that day. Obviously, the game was moved with the weather and that, so got down to see them. Great to see them up close and personal, because on the tape it's never quite the same, but very, very big side. They've got big men all over the pitch, and obviously some big names, and Tommy Walsh, David Moore, and Jack Savage, Barry John Keane, to name but a few. So they have a nice spread of talent across it, and they play a nice brand of football, so it should be a huge test. They looked impressive that day, and they dug it out, even though the other guys came back at them, but they were still comfortable winners, I think, in the end.
All the best there to Robbie and the boys at Croke Park from Kilmacud Crokes tomorrow, and hopefully in a couple of weeks' time on the programme we're looking ahead to an All-Ireland final with them. Well, towards the end of the Christmas break, we heard the news that Na Fianna clubman Johnny Cooper had announced his retirement from inter-county football. No fewer than 7 Celtic crosses were to make their way to the Cooper household, with countless Leinster, National League and a couple of All-Star awards as well. As part of the greatest Dublin team of all time from 2013 to 2020, his leadership skills on and off the park stood out immensely. And no matter what dressing room Dublin are in 2023, starting with Division 2 of the Allianz National Football League against Kildare at Croke Park in a few weeks' time, his presence will be greatly missed. Johnny Cooper, we say thanks for the memories and your loyal service to Dublin football, and we look forward to catching up with you soon at a Dublin game or even an Na Fianna club game possibly as well. Finally, this week, we extend our sympathies on the programme to the Kiernan and Gilroy families on recent bereavements. Patsy Kiernan was the caretaker at Parnell Park for many a long year. He was the first person you would meet as you approached the dressing room area of the Nell, and many a cup of tea was shared in his company as the affairs of Dublin GAA were discussed in the kitchen. He was almost most courteous, helpful and accommodating, even when you needed the odd time, it must be said, to push the boundary to get the job done. Tremendous character, tremendous servant to Dublin GAA. Rest in peace, Patsy Kiernan. Earlier in the week, the death was announced of Patricia Gilroy from St. Vincent's. She was the wife of club legend Jackie and mother of, amongst others, former Dublin player and manager Pat, who of course is back with the county footballers for this year. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Gilroy family at this particular time.
Time for NFL now, delighted to be joined in the new year by the one and only Stephen O'Brien. Good morning, Stephen, how are you?
I'm good, Reg. Good. My God, the news in the NFL. What a way to start the new year, huh?
Yeah, absolutely terrible. For those that don't know, of course, Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin suffered a cardiac arrest and had to be resuscitated on Monday Night Football last against the Bengals. Harrowing scenes, it has to be said, looking at all the players on their knees praying and hoping that he could be resuscitated. It seems to be more positive news. He seems to be making a bit of a decent return.
Yeah, it seems to be. Do you know what, Reg? I mean, this is one of those things. The NFL, when I'm on talking on the radio, I'm very conscious that, you know, you talk to people who are experts in the game, and then you also talk to people who have sort of a passing interest, and then some people who don't have an interest whatsoever, and they probably go off and make the toast and the tea and everything else when this segment is on. But I think news like this sort of doesn't cross kind of boundaries. You know, we've seen it with Christian Eriksen in soccer, football, where he had a cardiac arrest on the field, you know, was clinically dead. And then he was resuscitated on the field. And then we had the story of Fabrice Muamba, I think it's about 10 years nearly exactly now, for Tottenham, where he collapsed. Again, he was clinically dead, Reg, for 78 minutes. So when a story like this hits, it kind of just ripples throughout all of sports. Because, I mean, why are we, you know, we've the sports show where, in a way, it's sort of an escape from all of the seriousness and mortality and all of those grim sort of existential crises. And when something like this happens, Reg, you know, it kind of takes it back a little bit, because you realise that obviously there's something so much bigger than sport. And when we watch it to get away, when, as you said at the top there, you know, when you're watching the screen and a player goes down and then you see other players physically crying, you know, some people actually throwing up, you see some people praying, you know, it's really, really jarring. But like you said, I mean, you know, he's showing signs of improvement, but it didn't look like that from the beginning. Mm. And for people who don't know, what happened was is that it was a really innocuous looking tackle. Again, he's a safety, so he plays for the defence. Not an awful lot of people knew who he was, Reg, to be honest, coming into this game, which is fantastic that we do know who he is now, because this really put a spotlight on the man and what he was like off the field. And he had a toy drive and he seemed like a really, really nice guy. But he just goes in for sort of a really normal looking tackle. T. Higgins for the Bengals strikes him in the chest. But again, it's kind of from the side, Reg, so it doesn't look like it doesn't look like a bulldozing hit, because I'm sure you've played in games where a lad has absolutely steamrolled a guy and you hear the crowd react. It was none of that. I mean, the guy just sort of made an innocuous tackle. They went to the ground. But apparently what had happened was, and it's very early doors, but what's great about, you know, the news cycle this time around is that you'll actually have medical doctors who will get online and they'll give their take on it. So apparently what happened was something called commotio cordis, which is a really super rare stuff doctors only read about in textbooks, where if you get a blunt trauma to the chest, at the exact millisecond that your T wave in your heart, because your heart has different waves, and that T wave is coming back up. Once you get hit there, Reg, like it literally has to be, it's a
split second, a millisecond, a freak
accident. So he got hit in the chest there and apparently his heart stopped. So they had to revive him on the field, which brings so much more to light, you know. I mean, the NFL, let's have a look, Reg. I mean, COVID, did it stop? No, they just stopped the crowds coming in. They made the players go into their bubbles. They had to isolate it to get vaccinated. But life went on. We've talked about games as well, Reg, where you can't even see the hash marks on the field because it's covered in snow. Mm. Do they postpone the game? No. There's a hurricane that happened, Reg. It destroyed the city that they were in Florida and all this. Did they postpone games? No, they just moved it to a different stadium. And a tragic case as well was Chris Hughes in 1971. He was a wide receiver for the Detroit Lions. He suffered a cardiac arrest on the field, Reg, and he died. Never recovered. He was carted off the field in an ambulance. Did they stop the game? No, they continued. And that was brought into the spotlight again on Monday Night Football when this happened, Reg. This guy goes down. People are praying on the side of the field. Apparently, the NFL turned around and told the coaches and the players, some of who were weak at the knees, and said, listen, lads, 5 minutes, get on the bikes, warm up. We're going to restart this game. And only that the coaches and the players turned around and took a stand and said, we are not going back out onto that field, did they postpone the game. And now they've turned around and said that, look, okay, we can't play the game because it's this late in the season, so we've just postponed it, we'll cancel it, it's not going to happen. But lads, cleat up and prepare to play the New England Patriots in 5 days' time. So it also brings into sort of light, Reg, that the NFL, you know, as much as we love it and how great it is and the highlight reels, it highlights two things. Number one, how dangerous it is, and we know that, and we see the head injuries and the concussions and all of that kind of stuff. And the other one is that it can be quite heartless. You know, I mean, here's a sport that literally doesn't stop. You know, even 9/11, they postponed the games as well, but then they ran out onto the field a couple of weeks or whatever later with American flags to try to get on with it, you know. So it's just a money machine, and it just keeps on going. And but as you said, look, he's, for anybody concerned, he's seemingly made a fantastic recovery. They removed the breathing tube, and he actually FaceTimed into the team meeting to tell the team that he loved them and stuff like that. So it's looking very promising. He's still classed as being in critical condition. But it seems to be, Reg, the makings of a success story like we've seen with Ericsson and like we've seen with Mwamba. But yeah, just absolutely jarring scenes on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, I suppose the fact that it's highlighting issues. I remember a tragedy myself in rugby. I mean, we were busy celebrating a Triple Crown victory and a young player, John McCall, playing for the under-19s Ireland World Cup against New Zealand and South Africa, died from sudden death syndrome, I think they were calling it at the time. You know, that sudden cardiac arrest that happens in young players. And I suppose if there had been defibrillators or if there was more knowledge about it, more awareness, maybe something could have been done, but who knows. But I suppose the fact that there is that awareness, at least, you know, there's they're waiting, they're there to react to the situation should it happen. So it's tragic, there's no doubt about it, for John McCall. But please God, we'll be looking at a good story with Damer Hamlin. Okay, well, I mean, back to the football itself, it's winding down, obviously coming to an end. But where does it stand at this stage, and the old Super Bowl coming up?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the final week in the regular season, and it's very hard for anyone who covers the NFL. You'll have to do Damar Hamlin to sort of get back to it. But unfortunately, as I said, the NFL machine rolled on. And the Bills, who suffered, you know, it's their team that are in the mire, so they are going up against the New England Patriots. But look, it's the last week of the season, and this is the part where usually what happens now, Reg, is that, you know, people don't usually make it to the playoffs at this stage. These games are usually garbage games. And what you'll find is that someone who's going for the number one seed, and that means that they're at the top of their sort of AFC or NFC, and that's a much coveted place, because if you get the number one seed, well, then you get a week off to rest and recuperate. So that's what players usually do, or they're trying to leapfrog up the seeding. So, you know, it's really bizarre that it comes down to the last week, and there's still teams looking to try to get into the playoffs, and the main focus involves my beloved Packers as well. So when you look at it, I mean, it's just this insane stuff going on. So we have the Seattle Seahawks, we have the Detroit Lions, and we have the Green Bay Packers, and all of those are trying to get in for their last spot in the playoffs. So the Seahawks, if they win, they leapfrog the Lions, and then they can get in. And the only way they can get in is if the Packers lose. So the Lions are hoping the Seahawks lose. And if they do, well, then it's a Sunday night football game against the Lions and the Packers. And it's one of those things, you know, sport is, if you were to write it in a movie, Reds, it's almost better because it's like a script, you know. So if it comes down to it, that whoever wins that game against the Lions and my beloved Packers will go into the playoffs, which is incredible, because the Packers had a 1% chance of making the playoffs. They were sitting at 4-8, and they won all the rest of their games. And literally, I get on here and I do my hacket, right? And I get trounced all the time, because all of a sudden, like, it's the first time since 1977 that a game has ever came back from 7 million points to win the game, and it destroys their hacket, right? But the Packers needed sort of an hacket-style thing to fall their way. They needed 5 or 6 games a week to go their way. Every single one of them went their way. And now they're within one game of making the playoffs, which is absolutely incredible. So it's all eyes on that. But it's nearly set now. The playoff scenario is nearly set. So after this happens, after this week happens, then we roll into the playoffs. People who get the number one seed take a week off. That's only one team now. And of course, this game being postponed because of this tragedy happening has sort of mixed and jumbled around the playoff scenarios as well, because they decided not to play that game. So they might even be playing a playoff game on a neutral site, which after all the tragedy, people start to bubble up to the top again and go, oh, this is disgraceful, you know, and they kind of ignore the fact that the man sort of fighting for his life in hospital. But look, it's still an exciting week. Some of the games don't mean anything because the teams are well gone now at this stage.
Yeah.
But after now, Reg, it hits the knockout stage with the playoffs, which is really, really exciting now from next week.
Thanks for listening to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken and Reggie. Have a good weekend.